This is Voices of Our World. I'm your host, Eileen Bott. To say the least, it's a tumultuous time to be a Muslim. Recent Western involvement in the Islamic world has opened up old animosities and given the world a direct look into contemporary Muslim religion, culture, and custom, much of which doesn't seem very contemporary to many societies around the globe. The consequences of this friction between the West and the Arab world are often violent, as shown by the recent Muslim riots in Europe over the cartoons of Muhammad and the daily events in Iraq. Yet there is an internal jihad happening within Islam as well, the feminist jihad. While the Sunnis and Shia haggle over democracy and Islamic terrorists target infidels, Islamic women are slowly embracing Western values, such as civil and equal rights, and in some cases even refer to themselves as Islamic feminists. We here at Voices of Our World are pleased to have one of these brave women with us today. Ghazal Omid's new book, Living in Hell, explains in harrowing detail exactly how dangerous life can be for a defiant Muslim woman as the Islamic world debates whether to reform or to resist. Join our Eleanor Ostrinsky as she talks to Ghazal Omid on the state of feminism in the Muslim world.
Thank you for having me. This is author Ghazal Omid. We are in Manhattan, I guess, in New York City. I'm on my book tour, and it has been a pleasure to meet you.
Ghazal Omid.
Correct.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about your life in Iran before the revolution.
I was born to a family of four and then my second wife, and I was the last child of the four kids. Unfortunately for me, in most families, the last child is the dearest one. In my case, it didn't work that way. And when I grew up, I was almost a step tool to step on. And for some reason, my brothers took me as a competition. And it was very, very hard to grow up in a family that my father was very abusive. I don't mean physically, but he was emotionally really abusive toward my mother. And I watched him through going through a series of emotion. And he always used my mother as a revolving door. He came to the family whenever he wished and exited when he didn't want to. So he left me when I was 7 years old, and then he came back when I was 9, and then he left again when I was 12. And I've not known him ever since then. It was to a point that my older brother, the last one, took advantage of me, molested me for over a year, and it got to a point that I could not tell anyone, and at age 13, I almost killed myself. My friends told my mother, and life as a child was extremely, extremely difficult. I mean, we all know that we go through teenagers, and we all know that we go through hormonal changes, but having someone molest you and not be able to tell anyone, and even when I try to tell, my mother's reaction was, well, if the girl sort of loses her virginity or loses herself, she's had to put to death or given to anyone that comes to the door. Basically, I felt that I'm useless and a dishonor to the family. So I kept the secret, but I lost my faith. I said to myself, how could a God that we all worship so many times a day, and we all know that he's everywhere, he will be able to witness this, and he won't do a thing. And for some reason, I felt that it was his fault, and I challenged him. My mother was go to Mecca when I was age 13, and I said to her, if this God of yours is true, he's going to make come with you. And true, I guess God took that challenge. And the next thing I know, I was on plane to Mecca at age 13, which is quite unheard of for Iranian Muslim families, because laws of Iran does not allow under 18 go to Mecca. But there was a loophole in the law. If your father or someone buys the Mecca, and then later they would give it to you, you can do it. And I had no idea that was a law.
Wait, so are you telling me that if your father buys the ticket to Mecca, then you can go.
Yes, he didn't buy it for me. Actually, he got paid for the Mecca trip. He said, "I'll sell it to you," and we had to borrow money from my Jewish family friend in order to go Mecca. I mean, literally, my Jewish friend lent us the money for me to go. And as I have indicated in my book, I had this wonderful, wonderful relationship with these people, Mr. Sassonis. I hope that wherever they are in heaven, and their family knows that I have always been grateful to their fathers. He was the first man in my life that taught me a lesson of humanity. And I know it sounds hypocrite coming from, let's say, a five-year-old kid at the time, but when my father wasn't there to teach me lessons of humanity, this man was. He was the most decent, honest man I had known at that time. And he was the rabbi of the synagogue, and he kept money and other goods for people and returned it to them as it was. And to this day, I have that habit. And I guess I can be grateful for the fact that I was born to this family, so I had to live in that house for a while. And these are lessons, or these are my fate. I do have less fate in let's say my destiny was predestined, but there are certain things in my life that I cannot understand. I cannot explain to you or anybody else, but they happened, and it made me who I am today, and therefore I'm grateful, and I want to pass it on to the next generations.
If you're just joining us, this is Voices of Our World, and we're talking with Ghazal Omid about her new book, Living in Hell. The implications of a feminist jihad in the Arab world would be far-reaching. The Islamic model for family, marriage, and society relegates women to second-class status, and to reform the role of women within Islam would be to strike at the heart of Muslim culture and gender relations. But what does the Quran actually say about the role of women? Ghazal Omid believes that Islam has been hijacked by corrupt religious and secular leaders who then distort Islamic law in order to maintain power, often to the detriment of Islamic women. We continue our discussion.
The role of a woman in Iran changed drastically, or the life of a woman in Iran changed drastically from before 1979 and to now. How do women in Iran live right now?
Life for a woman in Iran is not pretty. They get up in the morning, they cook and clean, they go to work if they have work, or they stop doing, they go to different sort of lineups for milk and cream and other things. Things that you don't even care about in here. And then they come home, they cook and clean again, their children come home, they go to bed with their husband, either right in front of their kids or not, and they do it all over again the next day. It's really, in my view, it's a pointless life. It's your marriage, it's your family that makes you complete. I think it's you that makes you complete. You have to be happy with yourself. And I know this is not exactly a political issue, but if you look at it more broadly, it does. Why are we having so many Westerners in different countries working become an expert? Why the people of that country are not the expert? The reason is because they do have something those other people don't. And why are we satisfied with life in Canada, US, or Western world? Is because we live individually. We live for ourselves. We don't live for our neighbor, for our friends, or for anybody else for that sake. And that's the cultural difference between us and the Middle Eastern. And that's why they always sort of question the women, why the women are the way that they are in the Western society, why, and they're a little afraid, to be honest with you. And putting this to example is, I've tried to sell my book to Virgin Company in Dubai. They love it. They want to buy it. So they told me to send them either a book or give them copies from my publisher. And I said, sure. Then they told me that you have to pass Minister of Information. So a friend of mine took me to a lawyer to expedite that that process. The lawyer himself is an author as well as lawyer. He reads my book, or he reads actually not my entire book, but two sentences of it. And he calls me and he goes, "You know what, Ghazal, you're offending Islam, you're offending Arab people. I'm not going to let your book come into this country." I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "You're such an independent woman that we don't want people like become like you." I said, "What are you afraid of? A strong generation of women, or do you want a generation that will shiver under fear, or will do anything, will become a slave? Or do you want a strong generation that can stand up for themselves and for you as well?" He says, "Either way, we don't want books like yours in this country." I said, "Look, I'm gonna go on tour right now. I will be talking about this." He says, "You can do as you wish, but you're not going to be coming back to Dubai again. We're not going to let you come in." I said, "You know what? I don't have any property in here, so I don't have to. I will make my book available online as an ebook for any Arab woman that she want to download, that she want to read. I will make it available in Farsi for anyone that want to read. I will make sure that people in China, the country that doesn't allow Chinese people to read books like mine, to be able to read it. But I would be damned if I bend in front of governments like these and say you're right. Because they're not right. And just because we have a lot of trade with different countries does not mean that we have to sacrifice our human rights or our women rights. Religion is pure. Leave it aside. If you want to blame, blame the people. Blame the person. Don't blame the pure religion. And as humans, if we look at our either religion or background, we have more in common than we like to understand. We have a lot more in common, but unfortunately, we put all our emphasis and all our energy on our differences. And we destroy ourselves.
It's true.
Thank you.
So thank you.
Pleasure. I always say to people, don't blame the religion on something you don't like. Blame the man, blame the people, that they actually practice it.
Tell us what you think. Can Islam successfully balance its traditional religious beliefs with the Western values of democracy and freedom? Email us at radio@maryknoll.org or go to our website, www.voicesofourworld.org. Just click on Contact Us. You can call us at 877-MARY-KNOLL. That's 877-MARY-KNOLL. Well, that's all for this week, and thanks for listening. Azra Nomani and Ghazal Omid are just some of the voices of our world. I'm your host for this week's show, Eileen Bott. This show was produced by Eleanor Ostrinsky and Michael Jones. Our website is www.voicesofourworld.org, where you can listen, learn more about today's guests and topics, answer our weekly question, or subscribe to our podcast. Please go to www.voicesofourworld.org. To learn more about Mary Knoll or try Mary Knoll magazine in English or Spanish, call 877-MARY-KNOLL. That's 877-MARY-KNOLL. And please join us next time for more Voices of Our World.